Today is Thursday. It's February 4th, 2021. It is 1:40 in the afternoon. Hi, I'm John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals, another edition of the podcast we record every week throughout Chicagoland via Zoom. You can listen to me on WGN Radio. I'm on weekdays from 9 to noon.
I'm Austin Burke from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Heather Sharone, politics reporter for WTTW News.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the unvaccinated columnist from the Tribune.
Well, Eric, you're 1B, right?
1B?
Yeah. Are you in category 1B? You're eligible to get it right now?
No, but I'm just unvaccinated. Well, there are people who are younger, who are under 65, as I am, who have gotten the vaccine because they work in health-related fields. I know someone who works for the University of Chicago Health System in an office job, who is because of the connection with the University of Chicago Health Systems got vaccinated. So there are people who are younger than 65 who are getting vaccinated who aren't necessarily, I mean, not that podcasters aren't like on the front lines of essential workers and columnists.
Especially remote podcasters.
Yeah, working at home podcasters.
You just never know. You just never know. So
you saw Elizabeth Rosenthal's commentary in the New York Times on Sunday. She wrote about this very thing, how some hospitals, of course, are getting the vaccine and giving it to their frontline workers. But when the CDC said medical employees first, they didn't mean radiologists reading x-rays from home or the public relations staff or the people who have no connection to anybody that might be sick. But they are even giving it to the members of the board of some of the hospitals. And she was disappointed in the ethics of some people, if nothing else, right? I mean, we really don't have a good system anyway, but she was disappointed in the ethic that we're seeing out there. I take her point.
I take your point, too. And, you know, I'm unvaccinated, and I'm certainly resigned to the idea of waiting until April, May, probably, before my turn comes up. But, you know, there are people who I really do believe belong higher than me in the priority list, whose safety and well-being is much more important than mine at this point. So I think it is obscene that marketing people and spokespeople and office workers who are currently at home are jumping in line ahead of people who are actually interfacing with the public. So.
She didn't, though, yell at me when I ran my idea by her of vaccinating everybody in Major League Baseball first.
Yelled at you.
No, she did not. She did not. I said, just hear me out on this. It's 4,000 people. We got 328 million of us. 4,000 people aren't going to upset the queue. And then we can have baseball without any worry about it. And that's not a frivolous thing.
Do you have the same view about politicians, John?
How about that?
Illinois General Assembly members go before or after baseball players?
Answer that question for yourself. What do you think about that?
It's optically very difficult to understand. And of course, this happened to it at the congressional level. So, you know, Illinois' congressional delegation did get vaccinated. The thing that is worrisome to me in some of the folks I've talked to about why that decision was made to put, and for everyone's context, members of the Illinois General Assembly are now, you know, have the green light. They're going to go, even if they're young, even if they don't have any comorbidities, they are in line to get the vaccine. And partially this was done because J.B. Pritzker needs some votes to shore up his budget. And chief among them is this measure that would hike taxes by $500 million to $1 billion on small businesses. And it's not an awesome look when you are putting politicians in front of people who are on the front lines every single day at serious risk in order to take a tax hike vote. I mean, not a great look.
But you're not suggesting that he was bribing them with the vaccine, but rather that would get them there to be able to give him the vote that he wants, right?
Exactly. Because still a year into the pandemic, the Illinois House has not voted to be able to take, you know, remote votes. The Senate is doing a lot of committee work remotely, but the House has kind of sat on its hands. And I do think this was very much a carrot to get them to come back to Springfield.
when this first started to go down, Lori Lightfoot got one of the very first vaccines. And
I, just for clarity's sake, Lightfoot didn't get it until it was 1B in Chicago. And the city's guidance made legislators and some city workers immediately available for the vaccine. So they did what Pritzker did this week immediately and faced almost no blowback. And Lightfoot's argument was pretty much the same as Pritzker, is that aldermen are community leaders. I'm a Black woman. I'm a Black gay woman. People need to see somebody like me getting this vaccine to alleviate vaccine hesitancy as much as we can. So I think at least at the city level, that played a much larger role in making aldermen and some city officials eligible for the vaccine.
And I wondered if we would afford the people in the, at the legislature the same sort of consideration. Maybe it's good that we see legislative leaders get it, because then not only can they do the state's business, but it'll be a reminder, go get the vaccine if you get a chance.
I'm not sure that's why they're doing it, John. I think it has to do more with what they call continuity of government, which is if you were to have a really serious outbreak among the legislature, that would harm their ability to do the people's business. I think Pritzker should have gotten the vaccine. I think it's fine that the General Assembly is getting the vaccine. I'd like to see them get back to work. I think this business where they're not meeting and they're fighting having remote meetings is just nonsense. Like, they ought to be meeting. They ought to be dealing with the issues that this state has to deal with. And if we can give them some shots and make them feel better about coming together, I'm all for it. There's only, 118
in the House and what's in the Senate, 60?
Half of that in the so, yeah, so we're talking about less than 200 people. And, you know, that's not the scale of the vaccine problem by any means. I'm just not going to obsess about that. Mm-hmm, I think that people in government service like that who do need to make critical decisions at this time, I'm okay with them getting the shot myself.
Even if you don't like them.
If I could have just the people I agree with get the shot, right? I would do that.
Crazier things have happened lately. Heather, were you going to make a point?
Well, I was just going to say that, one, if the goal is to get legislators back in session, then we also need to vaccinate the janitors, the cafeteria workers, the all of the support.
Legislative staff. Yeah.
All of the legislative staff and the reporters who would be covering that session. And I think that a lot of legislators were alarmed when there were positive tests after the brief fall veto session. And I think that scared a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I would say that this is just another legacy of the really inconsistent and unclear federal guidance that was in place when the vaccine rollout started in mid-December, which was, of course, before Joe Biden was inaugurated. There were not clear guidelines set by CDC. There were recommendations by a federal committee, but the states were under no obligation to follow those to the letter of the law. And a lot of the states did whatever they wanted to do, which is why you saw, like in Kentucky, I believe, the governor got vaccinated on the first day of the rollout. So I don't know that this is, you know, some sort of huge plot to, you know, win legislative support for one thing or another. But it's a legacy of the fact that there are not clear rules, and the fact that people just feel like their lives are at risk. So they're going to do what they have to do to get what they see as a life-saving shot. And, you know, I've heard a lot of people liken this vaccine rollout to the Hunger Games, and it's 100% accurate. And I think that we do a disservice as journalists if we focus on sort of individual cases of individual people getting the vaccine without sort of focusing on the overall systemic inequity that our country exists in our country at every level. And this is just another reflection of that.
1B is too broad a category. It's too broad a category. I would carve out 1BA, 1BB, 1BC, something like that. I mean, I'd put teachers ahead of talk show hosts, and those would be painful decisions, but somebody gets paid to do that. Somebody do that. I'm hearing more and more stories every single day from people figuring out how to game the system to get the vaccine. And by the way, there's two stories happening at the same time, too, aren't there? The people that are doing that, and then the people that absolutely won't take it. The percentage of Republicans who say they would not take the vaccine were it offered to them is over 50%. The percentage of people working in nursing homes who say they will not take the vaccine if it's offered to them. Maybe those are people of color. I don't know. But is over 50%. You've got both of those things happening at the same time. And so as a result, it's just kind of chaos.
I would think that if you were working in a nursing home, it could be a occupational requirement. In fact, I'm wondering the degree to which the government can or should take control of something like this and say, no, we can't have flight attendants not be vaccinated. Once, you know, they can't turn down the vaccine, let's say.
It's a medical thing.
And anybody working in a hospital setting, anybody working in an extended care facility, things like that, those people ought to be vaccinated. And if they don't want to be vaccinated, then they can find other work. That would be how I would look at it, that this is something that is so important. Now, yeah. if a journalist decides not to get vaccinated and wants to, that's a different situation. I think this is one that requires, you know, sort of mandatory vaccines for certain kinds of jobs. And maybe employers should be.
You know, students have to have the vaccine to go, other vaccines to go to public schools. I want to go to what's been happening in Washington, D.C. lately, and then we'll circle back to some of the state and local stuff. In the history of this country, the Congress has expelled members, I believe the number's 20 times. Almost every one of those was for the crime of fighting for the Confederacy. Since the Civil War, two members have been expelled. In 1980, it was Democratic Representative Michael Myers, and in 2002, it was Democrat James Traficant, both convicted for bribery and other charges. We have today Looney Tunes crank Marjorie Taylor Greene. The question for you guys is, what should the Congress do? Should they censure her? Should they restrict her from committee assignments? Or, as they've done 20 times before, should they kick her out of the Congress completely? As we go to pod, as they say, the Congress has just stripped her, if I'm not mistaken, right, of her committee assignments. Is that it?
She's been removed from the Education Committee and the Labor Committee by a vote of the full Senate, or by the full House. Sorry.
She sounded apologetic on the floor, but also combative. And she said that if it weren't for the Facebook posts and comments that she liked in 2018, she wouldn't be in the trouble that she's in today. She asked not to be judged by things she said before the election, although after the election, she was wearing that face mask that said Trump won. And she's also said that some of the stuff posted on her social media was not done by her, that it was done by somebody else who she assigned to manage her social media.
Yeah, can I just interject to call nonsense on that? That is completely unlikely that someone who was a private citizen who was running for Congress gave her social media. I mean, and these posts go back several years. That at some point, I mean, nobody deputizes somebody else to run their social media account unless they're very prominent. It's possible that since she was elected, someone was doing that, but that's just nonsense. That's rubbish.
You guys don't have personal interns that tweet for you?
I do.
Well, I do, but
yeah, okay. Good. Just making sure we're on the same page.
Is it reasonable to draw the line in the sand for somebody's social media and say, okay, we're not going to hold you accountable for stuff you did 5 years or 10 years ago or when you were 17?
I mean, her arguments have, I think, been pretty awful universally, and she is cuckoo.
I don't know how much you guys know about Q. It's an anonymous person. Q is a patriot. We know that for sure. But we do not know who Q is. But I'm just going to tell you about it because I think it's something worth listening to. According to him, many in our government are actively worshiping Satan, or they call Moloch. Now, remember, I told you that there was an email that came out of the WikiLeaks emails that flat out said, Cheryl Moles said to Hillary Clinton, I'm going to sacrifice a chicken in my backyard to Moloch. If that's not evidence.
She is, there is a crazy person in Congress. Her name's Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Big media companies can take teeny tiny pieces of words that I've said, that you have said, any of us, and can portray us into someone that we're not.
What she said is despicable, and she said a lot of despicable things that are just beyond the pale.
Real quick, give me an example. What are we talking about here?
Hillary Clinton personally scared a child in order to elicit some kind of chemical, and then wore the kid's skin as a face mask. Just one of the many, you know, the cavalcade of stars here for Representative Greene. So there's that. That's beyond the pale. It is incumbent upon Republicans to censor her. She shouldn't have committee seats. She shouldn't have any decision-making party power in the party apparatus. where I get conflicted is on this idea where of, and Kevin McCarthy made the claim that this was the first time a majority party had voted to remove, sort of led the charge to remove minority power from a minority party member from committees. It's usually obviously left to the minority party themselves. What I worry about here is sort of a Chekhov's gun situation where you don't necessarily want the majority party, regardless of who it is, to have the precedent set that they can just kick people off of committees regardless of the crazy things that they do. That's all the more reason to focus on the fact that the Republican Party itself needs to deal with this problem. So that's kind of where my head is at. The Republicans have left themselves open to this kind of action by not addressing it themselves. But I don't necessarily think the right way to go about it is for the majority party to vote this person off of committees. And also, final point, you could see this making her sort of a martyr within her district, which would be bad. Maybe if Republicans did it, she would be equally a martyr, but I don't think it's the same when you have the Democratic Party voting to remove her.
I totally share your reservations about the idea that they have created a precedent here. The Democrats have created a precedent in which if they lose the House, then you might see a Representative Tlaib or an AOC get knocked off their committees by a majority vote. Because, hey, you did it to our person, we're going to do it to yours. The question, though, is whether Marjorie Taylor Greene is so extreme. And what I would like to know, and maybe, Heather, you know this, is there was a roll call vote, I assume. Was it a completely party line vote?
Pretty much, yeah.
So Republicans have actually, you know, even some of our Illinois Republicans are now on record as supporting Marjorie Taylor Greene. In that way, it's a very clever political move on the Democrats' part, because they're going to be able to go back at these, especially in some of these closely contested districts, and say, you voted for the woman who thought that Hillary Clinton cut faces off little children and sucked up their blood. You voted for her to stay on committee.
I think this debate is too complicated for what it actually is. I mean, the fact of the matter is that there is a video of Marjorie Taylor Greene saying, and she also liked Facebook comments to the effect that Nancy Pelosi should be shot.
It's a crime punishable by death is what treason is. Yeah. Nancy Pelosi is guilty of treason.
I think it's a pretty clear, bright line to say anybody who endorses or calls for violence against another member of the body is not entitled to sit on committees. And I think that we heard the White House press secretary Jen Psaki address that directly yesterday to say, look, if there was a Democrat who did this, we wouldn't get to a full vote of the House to strip them of committees, because the Democratic Party would have taken that step directly. So, you know, that seems like a pretty clear, reasonable, bright line to draw, especially after the insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th. So I'm not sure that all of this sort of back and forth about what sort of precedent it sets is really relevant. The other thing is we've seen time and again that deplatforming people like Milo, the far right provocateur who got banned from Twitter years ago, deplatforming works. I mean, imagine Marjorie Taylor Greene on the Education Committee asking victims of school shootings to prove that they were actually victims of the incident, right? Like that was what was sort of on tap here. So you can say that that's not appropriate. That's not, you know, that's not acceptable. And I think you can make an argument that the Capitol insurrection is sort of the culmination of sort of saying, we're just going to avert our eyes. We're just going to hope that just by ignoring these people, that they will stop saying these things. And there's no evidence that that works. And I do not share any concerns about making her more popular in her district. As I said on this podcast last week, her district knew who she was. They knew what she believed. She was a social media star in Georgia who was pro, you know, sort of QAnon and MAGA and all of that.
But you're not saying throw her out. You're not saying that the Congress should kick her out, because when we got to that point, I think I made the point, and I will again this week, they get to have whoever they want.
Right. I think there's an argument to be made that she was duly elected and that, you know, unless she actually engages in physical violence, you know, or, you know, sedition, she doesn't get to lose her seat.
The Republicans got rid of Representative King from Iowa They just stripped him of committees. I know, they basically ended up shoving him out of the party in a way.
Right.
They stripped him of committees, and all he did. Well, what he said was, as I recall, was that like when did white power become a bad thing?
Yeah,
something like that.
Well, he did like a Seinfeld bit of like, what's the big deal with white supremacy? This sort of is.
Well, I mean, he also implied that black and brown Americans were having more babies to purposely replace white Americans, which of course is the great replacement theory of white supremacy. So, you know, it wasn't like he made one intemperate comment.
Right? No, but all I'm saying is I think that all his comments added up together don't come close to what Marjorie Taylor Greene did and said.
It's odd. There's never any evidence shown for a plane in the Pentagon.
And therefore, the failure of the Republicans, I mean, they could have nipped this in the bud because they took, I know they took a vote on Liz Cheney. They voted to keep her in leadership. But they could have taken maybe a similar anonymous vote to do that with Marjorie Taylor Greene. And then that would have basically not pushed it to this point, because now, like I said, you've got all these Republicans who are on the record saying, yes, we think this woman should have been on committees. We think she should have been on the Education Committee. I think that's speaking of Chekhov's gun, you have handed a weapon to every plausible Democratic challenger in 2022.
You know what I was thinking, too, though, is post-Donald Trump, where words mattered, but maybe not that much. And the insurrection is the great exception to the rule I'm about to cite. But maybe we shouldn't count words so much, right? Trump said crazy stuff all of the time, and that was just the way he talked. And I'm wondering the same about Marjorie Taylor Greene. Trump's last words had grave consequences, but I'm just wondering if when she said we should shoot Hillary Clinton or all of these other crazy things, you know, really, what of that? Do you think she really means that, or is that just what passes for political rhetoric these days? How much should you punish somebody for saying crazy stuff if crazy stuff is what they wanted to represent them in the House? But I think it's easy to overreact to some of her statements in the past.
I think it's completely within the Republican Party's power and appropriate to censure people when they're beyond the pale. That's a necessary part of what parties do. They should be a moderating force most of the time for stuff like that. To the point, though, about sort of like deplatforming, it's true deplatforming works. But I think also like Harry Reid may have said, like, nuking the filibuster works. It works today. But once the power is in play, it can be used in all sorts of ways that we wouldn't foresee, and it cuts both ways. So I think, like, to Heather's point, I think totally, like, deplatforming or, you know, censoring her in the party apparatus, which is what has typically been done, is an effective way to do things, but not necessarily, you know, removing her as a congressperson or having a majority party vote to strip her of leadership committees. Or of committee seats, I should say.
What about Adam Kinzinger? You guys were talking about how many Republicans voted. What about what the Republican Party in his, was it county or district, said? What was the number on that I saw, Eric? Was it 88%?
88% in LaSalle County.
LaSalle
County GOP. And Winnebago County is going to vote to censure him, too, reportedly. And
because he voted for the impeachment.
Because he voted for the impeachment, yeah.
And, because I think there were some sour grapes there of, like, they were saying, like, he hasn't talked to us in 6 years or something like that. I think it maybe was festering before the impeachment vote.
Well, you know, Kinzinger is hoping that down the line the Republican Party is going to sober up, is the language he uses, and they're going to realize this was a terrible four-year bender that they went on with Donald Trump, and they're going to return to the basic roots of the Republican Party, you know, small government, low taxes, anti-abortion, pro-gun, the sort of basic Republican thing. And they're going to leave this crazy outrage machine behind. And, you know, he has not been greeted warmly since he started his Country First initiative on Sunday. And we'll see where that goes. But I think that time will probably be kind to that effort. And we've spoken on this podcast before about whether he's angling for a state run, a statewide run, whether he's going to run for governor or the U.S. Senate in 2022, and what the Democratic Party might do to either draw him into a really comfortable district where he's going to win so they can keep him from running statewide, or they're going to just, like, draw him out of his district and put him in a red hot district and force him to run statewide, where he's probably going to have trouble in the primary. So I don't know. He said on a podcast last week that he probably is not interested in a statewide run. So I don't know what that means for his future.
Well, that means he's interested in a statewide run.
I wanted to add that although he will have a hard time in a Republican primary, probably if he runs in 2022, an example you could look to is Judy Bart Topinka, who ran for governor in 2006. Is that right, Heather?
Yes.
Okay, good. I was going to check with Heather. But she won that primary with, I think, like 38-39% of the vote, that some further right Republicans, like Oberweis was one of them, split that other vote. And so you can, if you thread the needle correctly, you don't have to get a majority of Republicans to win a Republican primary, at which point he has a much better chance, I think, running statewide, given his attempted bipartisan appeal. He's the kind of Republican that Illinois voters tend to elect a statewide office.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that's true. After Jeanne Ives came within a hair's breadth of dethroning Bruce Rauner in the Republican gubernatorial primary in 2018, I mean, had she had maybe a little bit more money and a little bit more name recognition, been a little bit smoother in media interviews, like, you know, it came pretty darn close after she came pretty darn close after making just really, you know, stomach churning comments about, you know, trans people and Black people and Latino people and Chicago teachers. I know I've said this before. It's just that I don't see any evidence that there's a moderate lane for somebody to run in the Republican Party anywhere. But if it is possible, it's probably possible in Illinois. I just think that you lose so many pro-Trump Republicans but you cannot make up enough Democrats to offset that, because there are Democrats now who are saying that they're never going to vote for another Republican, that they don't want to be associated culturally with the Republican Party. And I don't know how somebody like Adam Kinzinger splits that difference. I mean, I'm fascinated to see him try. So if he's listening, he should please run, because I'd like to cover it. But, you know.
Well, who are the let's think about this a little bit. Who are the Republicans who have won statewide? Rauner, Peter Fitzgerald. I mean, going back 20 years now.
you got to go back 20
for comptroller, right? Right. She won statewide.
So you have, but they tend not to be. Peter Fitzgerald was an interesting and kind of an odd duck. And again, that's going back. When was he elected? 98 or something like that?
And you can say that that's a reaction to Ross Dunkowski and the scandal there. Like, you know, he didn't win because he was Michael Fitzgerald, and he had a whole plan. He won because he was not Ross Dunkowski.
Well, and he also was running against Carol Moseley Braun, I believe, who had just a boatload of problems. So he kind of snuck in there. And he also, as I remember, he had sort of a moderate mean to him anyway. But I don't know. It's an interesting question. Who is going to win statewide? Rauner ran as a sort of new kind of Republican, a moderate Republican. Not in his record, he deliberately stayed away from any social issues. And Kinzinger can't really do that. Kinzinger, he first ran as a Tea Party guy, right? In 2010, he was a Tea Party guy.
Right.
And he's definitely anti-abortion, and he's very pro-gun. He is much more to the right politically than Bruce Rauner is. He's got a really appealing resume. He's very well spoken. You know, he's got his military thing happening. I urge people to go watch that video at countryfirst.org, I think it is, where he talks about, you know, his party and his country. And, you know, it's like, if I were a Republican, I would just be moved to tears by it.
If J.B. Pritzker were running today, would he win?
Ooh.
Depends against who. Like, replacement level Republican? I don't even know, like, what that would be. Some kind of lab-grown, just like, white guy with an R, like, stamped on his head or something?
Kind of, yeah. Just an avatar with an R on it.
Invigorated corpse.
Just an avatar with an R. Absolutely.
Yeah. If so, say it's JB versus that guy, I think it would be very close. I don't think JB's running away with it, and I definitely don't think the Republicans are running away with it. I think Pritzker's, when you poll around his handling of the pandemic, for example,
that's what I'm doing well. Here. Yeah.
Yep. He does pretty well on the handling of the pandemic. But if you just go by favorables, you know, what's your opinion of J.B. Pritzker as governor? You get a much more narrow result when you do that.
You give him a good score, though, on his handling of the pandemic?
I think his handling of the pandemic has been below replacement level by a lot.
Well, I thought you just said that he got good scores on that, but that his unfavorables were high.
I disagree with the majority opinion on that issue. Yeah. So I think it would be a tight race. The biggest issue, I think, for him is his tenure on jobs has been terrible. It's been the recovery from the pandemic in terms of economic growth has been terrible, especially hurt the Latino community, the Black community, and women have fared much worse in Illinois than in other states where the impact of the pandemic was comparable. And even before the pandemic, Illinois was losing jobs in an expansion year. So I think he's failed to put together really a track to recovery, especially economically for the state. And it hurts people from all backgrounds.
I think all three of us hear every day from people that are frustrated with the vaccine rollout in Illinois. And that naturally reflects on the governor, fairly or not, I don't know. But Eric, what's your thought about how well JB's been handling it?
Well, I have a better opinion than Austin does on this, but because I think this is really such an unprecedented challenge. You look at the handling of the vaccine, you look at the Illinois Department of Employment Services and the waiting lines that you still hear about there that people can't get through to get their unemployment benefits. There are all kinds of problems. And of course, he failed with the with the fair tax, as I called it. So he's, you know, in a world of budget hurt. So the question then does become like, who's someone who's going to plausibly run against him, who's going to draw that, who's going to have the money and the heft to run against him. I think that the judgment about his handling of the pandemic is still TBD, that we're going to look back, I hope, within a year, maybe by this fall, we'll all be able to look back and say, yeah, Illinois did okay with this, or no, Illinois really screwed this up, that the postmortem is going to be really important. Not to derail this conversation at all, but I think the more interesting question is going to be, how's Lori Lightfoot going to do? Because right now she's had all kinds of problems, and with this CPS story, and with the turmoil on her staff and her frosty relations all around, I think that she's someone who seems to be in more political trouble, I think, than Pritzker.
Well, I agree with the question that Austin puts up, against whom, right? Like, who would run against JB? We'll come back to Lori in just one second, Eric, but I don't know who that person is either. But it just seems to be such a cluster for this vaccine rollout in the state of Illinois, and he's... I don't know. Is he in charge? It's a federal program. He's not manufacturing it. I'm not exactly sure who's at fault here. Like, I'm looking to point a finger, and it's easy to point it at JB because that's where the buck would stop. But I don't know if there's anything he actually can do, like something that he's literally failing at, that were he to do a better job at that, we would be getting the vaccine more readily. I don't know the answer to that.
And he and Lightfoot, you know, both, not just Pritzker, have been very readily pointing their finger at the federal government. So, you know, there's any kind of blame that could be set at the state level is immediately ratcheted up to the federal level, depending on, you know, actually not even depending on the issue, on pretty much any criticism that is where the blame
goes. Well, that's funny. Maybe that's why Lori Lightfoot was on MSNBC this week and not our radio station. I think I say this every podcast now. More Chicagoans listen to our radio station in the morning than watch MSNBC in the morning. If Lori Lightfoot really wanted to talk to people about what we're doing about it and how we're going to get better at it, she would come on local radio and not national TV. Sorry.
Didn't she blame Trump for CPS and CT for like the strike, the quote unquote strike? Yeah. I mean, like, it gets absurd at some point. Yeah.
Well, I mean, one of the sticking points between CPS and CTU is that there isn't enough vaccine to vaccinate all of the teachers. And her point was, if we had more vaccine, we could get more vaccine to teachers and this issue would be taken off the table.
Yeah.
You know, you can argue that both ways, but you know, she did a bunch of cable news this week, and she has taken questions from local reporters exactly once on Sunday and then once this morning in the midst of this sort of, you know, really tense moment of negotiations between CTU and CPS. And that, you know, it seems to be her strategy. I don't know how it's working for her. The schools and the district can't even decide on whether they should measure cases per school or per neighborhood or citywide. Like, that's a pretty significant disagreement on the basis of an agreement.
Well, CPS has answered that question.
And CTU says, no, it should be by school because that's where our members are and the students are going to be spending the bulk of their day. You know, this is just a disagreement about what color the sky is, honestly.
Today is Thursday. They're still not back in the classrooms today. And I think the grade schools have tomorrow off as a planned day off. So they're not going to get education again. My view hasn't changed. I still say get your butt in the classroom. Lisa isn't here. Lisa feels quite the opposite. Quite the opposite. Eric, has your view on that changed at all this week?
You know, I continue to be torn by this because, as I've said before, I have a great deal of respect for teachers, and I feel like they are all. I mean, for the most part, they are really all about the kids. I know that there's, you know, their union is it can make some problematic demands, but I know a lot of teachers who are really devoted to kids and whose hearts are breaking when the kids aren't being educated correctly, but who are also legitimately very concerned about the risks of going back into the classroom. As the story goes on, I'm feeling more and more like the system, the school system has to do something with, and the union have to get together, have to figure out a way to at least meet each other partway here. And this intransigence on both parts is troubling to me. Like they ought to be able to at least have some teachers go back and some students go back and some, you know, and make enough exemptions so that teachers of a certain age or teachers who have people at home mm-hmm. with comorbidity problems and so on can opt out. And I'm not a parent of CPS students anymore, so I don't have that same like daily impatience. But I'm feeling it as we go along. I'm feeling more and more like teachers ought to get back.
I think that's inevitable, too. And I'm waiting for Janice Jackson to say that. Even if she and the medicine and the science are right, and maybe they're not, but I'm on that team, right? But at some point you say, what is it you guys say sometimes? Don't let perfect be the enemy of good. Then go with that. Go with some hybrid that you don't like, that isn't even necessary, but at least it gets the teachers that are willing to risk it into the classroom because it's not that big a risk. Find a way to compromise. And Dr. Jackson and the CPS are not doing that right now. That's my read on it. Austin, do you have the same view of this?
Yeah, I think that's totally spot on. And the problem is if CTU, I think, at the top feels very much that if they give an inch on that, if any teacher are going back, even just the ones that want to go back, even the families that want to go back, it weakens their entire bargaining position. And I think that bargaining position changes by the day. There's these goalposts are consistently being moved. I totally agree with Heather on it seems like they can't agree on the color of the sky. I would also note that, you know, what you need in schools to make them safe, as you were saying, John, has become much more clear. Distancing, masks, ventilation. CPS says every place is ventilated, we're good to go. CTU, to my knowledge, publicly hasn't really offered a great rebuttal to what CPS is saying in terms of those accommodations that have been made. And every single day, I'm thinking of these parents who just have no voice at the bargaining table whatsoever. I mean, they are nowhere to be found. I would love if you could send three parents into every bargaining session with GoPros on their heads mm-hmm. to report back to everybody else, because right now there's just simply no transparency.
Yeah.
Political game.
That'd be interesting to see
kids
those
and parents lose.
I would like to see how that, do you guys have any insight on that? What is it like when one of these 60, 70 odd meetings now, what is that like?
Well, it's all done by Zoom. You know, they're not actually in a room, and you know, a story I would love to do, I guess if I was supplied with a bottle of truth serum is, you know, how has that changed the dynamic, right? Because it's recording this podcast via Zoom is different than when we used to do it all sitting at the same table. You know, I don't know if it was better or worse, or it just is, but I think that's part of the question. And, you know, and I think, you know, we've heard from the teachers say, look, if it's not safe enough for us to be in the same room to bargain, why is it safe enough for our students
fair enough,
in the classroom?
But we're pre-pandemic, if we were at this place, you would not have been allowed in the room where they were negotiating anyway, right?
No. And, although CTU has said they'd be fine with it. So it's always been the district saying, no, these are private negotiations.
I mean, I wanted to sort of circle this conversation back a little bit to Lori Lightfoot and say, you know, she drew a line in the sand for Monday, I think it was.
Right.
And then she used her feet and erased the line in the sand and asked for a cooling off period of 2 days. And then that cooling off period is extended to 3 days. It seems like she's looking kind of weak here. Like when you draw a line in the sand, I think you got to stick to it unless you've got some really, I mean, the negotiations just kind of stalled. She said, okay, well, forget my line in the sand. That did not inspire confidence in me. And then I wanted to ask Heather what she makes of Lightfoot's floor leader, Alderman Villegas, stepping down kind of abruptly, right? I mean, I guess maybe those of you really in the know saw that coming. But that looked kind of weird to me, too. And then her communications chief quit about a week and a half ago. It's looking a little chaotic and unsteady in the Lightfoot administration. Am I wrong?
No, I mean, Rahm Emanuel had one floor leader in 8 years. And the difference was when Alderman Pat O'Connor, who, of course, lost his seat in 2019, said the mayor is in favor of this legislation. By that point, he had the votes. And he didn't just have 26 votes. He had an overwhelming number of votes. So it was never in doubt. That is not how Alderman Villegas or Lori Lightfoot has been running the city council. And we heard her talk a little bit about that Thursday morning. She was asked about Alderman Villegas's departure. And she said, look, I don't buy votes. And what's interesting is that she was not asked whether she buys votes. Right? she was asked, why did Alderman Villegas leave? And I think that I think it's clear that her style of getting things through the city council has not been smooth. She only passed the property tax vote by 2 votes. That is an insanely small margin of error. And I think this is fallout from votes like that. And we've seen other high profile pieces of legislation from the mayor stall as well. For a while, her plan to allow the sale of marijuana was stalled by the Black Caucus. We've seen smaller pieces of legislation stalled as well. Most recently is an effort to crack down on industrial polluters didn't make it out of committee. In the past, if the mayor put forward something, he already had the votes. That's not how Lori Lightfoot operates. And she says, well, look, that's not how the city of Chicago, people of Chicago want me to operate. But I think there's a fine line between sort of being purely transactional, and certainly Rahm Emanuel faced criticism for being that way, and also just not being clear and direct and having a reasonable negotiating relationship with the majority of the city council. But let's not forget that it was 2 weeks ago when the mayor called 2 members of the city council racist and xenophobic, and then turned around and basically mocked her president pro tem for suggesting that marijuana should be sold downtown and in the Loop by declaring that she would not allow Chicago's Magnificent Mile to be transformed into a pot paradise. You know, had you asked Rahm Emanuel, hey, Alderman O'Connor wants to do X in his ward, he would have said, at a minimum, happy to talk with him about it, happy to have negotiations, happy to work on a solution for this problem in his ward. But that was not Lori Lightfoot's response. And I think those sort of responses are coming back to haunt her, although she would argue she campaigned on rooting out corruption in City Hall, and she made Alderman the face of that corruption. So she's in a really tough position. Now, her new floor leader is Alderman Michelle Harris, who is a protege of former Cook County Board President John Stroger. So somebody's going to have to explain to me about how we're going to root out corruption by tapping a member of like the most machine family in Chicago politics. And, that's tough. I was also reminded of January 2019 when we learned that Alderman Solis had worn a wire on Alderman Burke, and Alderman Michelle Harris basically said, why would Danny Solis go against the family?
Yeah.
Well, and of course,
bring in the light.
Well, at her inauguration, you remember Lightfoot turned to the she addressed corruption and basically turned to the alderman and gave him.
She basically said, "I'm looking at you all."
Exactly. So the idea that she is not a politician and doesn't and it says what she thinks that was supposed to be a feature is turning out to be kind of a bug.
Absolutely.
And there's a fine line, though, between being an effective politician and being an effective leader. And I think she's been effective really at neither. So in terms of the operations of the government, just day to day, in terms of vaccine rollout, other elements, and then also in terms of getting really any substantive agenda on any of the issues that she ran on through the city council. It is a very short list of legislative wins that Lori Lightfoot has had. And I'm reminded in this fight with between her and CTU of a parent who threatens a punishment and never follows through and they never learn.
What levers does she have?
Has the look of pure impotence. And a lot of that is because state law is completely stacked against her at the bargaining table with government worker unions. You cannot hold that against Lori Lightfoot, except for the fact that she could maybe raise that point a bit more regularly and pointedly than she does. But I think it goes back to this position of mayor in Chicago is one that is really designed to fail for a number of different reasons. And Lori Lightfoot has not inspired confidence throughout her tenure.
Well, what could she do, though, Austin, about the teachers? I mean, if they don't go, they don't go. She could say, I'm out of runway. I'm at my patient's end. They have all the cards, right? If they don't show up, they don't show up. I guess because you just can't summarily fire them either, can you?
Well, this is the frustration with how this CTU has operated politically, which is that they bring her to the point where the only thing she could do, the only trigger she could flip was removing their access, doing a virtual lockout, right? We were all waiting on bated breath to see, oh, are teachers going to be able to log into their email? But of course, that then looks like the mayor is harming the kids, but she's been put in the position to be forced to hurt kids in order to do something that we think would be helpful for children. So that whole system is completely rigged against her in that way. I think she could be more forthright about why that is.
Yeah.
But what power could she have that would allow her to address this particular situation?
That would be the one, right? You do a lockout, essentially. You do and that would have been virtual. And then that would have created a lot of rancor and pain, essentially, to improve her bargaining position to say, hey, look, CTU is refusing to work. But because of the nature of this situation,
wait. So you're saying they're
not refusing to work, and their answer is we're not refusing to work. We're refusing to work in person because we feel like it harms our health. But you were saying that the Chicago position of mayor is designed to fail, and obviously Mayor Daley, both Mayors Daley, served for many, many terms each, succeeding at least politically that way. So I'm wondering what change in state law or in the way council runs or the way the mayor runs. Would you suggest that would allow Lightfoot to address the situation? Because I don't know what, if I were in her position, I don't know what I would do. I know that I probably wouldn't draw a line in the sand if I wasn't going to stick to it. So
a huge problem is the fact that basically all of city government in Chicago revolves around the mayor. She has to deal with the police. She has to deal with the schools. She essentially runs the city council or is, you know, seated at the head of city council. And because of that, the mayor in Chicago needs to make all of these cross compromises with all of these groups in order to be able to do anything. So for decades, that looked like really bad deals, made like the parking meter deal, for instance, or 20-year contracts with public sector unions. And that, what I mean by failed, is that failed the people of the city. Now, when a mayor is stuck, like Mayor Lori Lightfoot is, between the FOP, between the CTU, you have to think of things in a way to say, is power distributed intelligently in city government? Why is the mayor, you know, the point person on negotiations with CTU? You could have an elected school board that takes that off of her plate. Similar with the police. Why is that all in the mayor's office? Why isn't that taken off her plate? Similar with the budget. Why is there not an elected controller or some kind of real budgetary authority in the city council? All of these things together, how you have to rethink city government. The way other cities have done it is through a city charter, a city constitution that actually lays that out and can't be changed on a whim by ordinance.
I was in Peoria for 10 years. They had a city manager. He ran the city and the mayor was the political arm. And That seemed to work out well for us. Do you like a city manager style government?
It can definitely work. I mean, big cities, it's been, you know, mixed results. I think a way better way to do it is have a charter commission, have them write up a charter for city government, have voters approve it. Works for LA, works for New York. It should work for Chicago.
But also, at the same time, the mayor has all these responsibilities, Austin. Our system of governance is referred to as a weak mayor system.
That's the point I was going to make, is that Chicago sort of has the trappings of a strong mayor form of government, but the mayor's actual power is very weak, which sets up a conflict between sometimes what the voters expect the mayor to be able to do and what the mayor can actually do beyond just sort of using his or her bully pulpit to force people to go along. And I think we had two mayors in Rahm Emanuel and Mayor Richard M. Daley who were very comfortable in using that bully pulpit and brooked no dissent and were happy to crack down when defied. I think that Lori Lightfoot's problem is one, you know, she's a lawyer by training, and I don't know that she sort of knows how to pull those levers the way that Rahm Emanuel and Mayor Daley did. And two, I think maybe she gets less sort of room to maneuver because let's not forget, she's a Black gay woman who did not come up through the Chicago machine. So Daley and Rahm literally had decades of chicks to call in or favors to trade, and they knew where the metaphorical bodies were buried. Lori Lightfoot doesn't have any of that background, and I think that that has come to, if not haunt her, it has complicated her job.
Let me ask Heather what you make of the turnover in her communications department. Is that, I think every mayor has a number of communications directors. Is that a sign of someone who is not a good manager, who is really, really, really hard to work for?
I mean, you know, to be quite honest, I don't know what percentage is she's a tough and demanding boss. And that is just the nature of who she is as a person. And, you know, sort of how burnt out these people have been, you know, dealing with all of this in the past year, because, you know, it was a teacher strike, and then it was a budget crisis, and then it was a pandemic, and then it was a social justice crisis, and it's been one thing after another. So it's hard to sort of parse out exactly what percentage of it was like people's just personal lives, like Inell Ruiz, her first press secretary, she, you know, she had a baby. Like, could I have done her job with a newborn and a three-year-old? Absolutely not. But I don't think that there's evidence to say that working for Lori Lightfoot is a picnic either. I think it's probably a little bit of both. But I don't think we can discount the fact that it's been, if not the most difficult year in Chicago politics, at least, you know, certainly, let's say top five.
Yeah, and I would say I don't know Rahm Emanuel that well, but I can't imagine he was easy to work for either. And certainly Daley wasn't easy to work for. So, I mean, in some ways, to get to that kind of position of power, you've got to be kind of a hard ass, and you're probably not a cuddly boss. And maybe that's again the question of feature and bug, that this is more of a feature that she's demanding. And
it does make me wonder if she'd want that first meeting with the city council back, though, where she was it a city council meeting that she,
her inaugural address?
Was that it?
Now, our four star must be integrity. I know. Putting Chicago government and integrity in the same sentence sometimes may seem a little strange. But friends, that's going to change, because it's got to change. For years, they've said Chicago ain't ready for reform. Well, get ready, because reform is here.
That was not calculated. You know what I mean? Like, she knew what she was doing. And this, you forget that her campaign was, I don't want to say dead in the water, but, she was not considered a top-tier mayoral candidate until Ed Burke's office got raided, until corruption became the story of the election. So for her to then not capitalize on that would have meant that she was then not catapulted into that top tier of mayoral candidates. And she, you know, has promised to make changes to the way City Hall is operated. The problem is that the mayor can't make those changes because it's actually a weak mayor. You know, she can't end aldermanic prerogative. She can't, you know, do all of these things that she said, I'm going to come to City Hall and do, without convincing 26 other aldermen to get on board with her. And she has not shown any sort of ability to negotiate a solution to those issues.
Did any of you hear my interview with John Catanzara, the head of the police union?
I did, yes.
I didn't know what to say to that guy. And once we got going, I wished I hadn't even begun the conversation, but he was in the news and there I was throwing some red meat at him. What's happening with his tenure as a Chicago police officer?
The Illinois FOP will be meeting sometime this week, if they haven't met already, to discuss his position. And then I think there would be a probably a national response, depending on what the outcome of that meeting is like.
And what is the crime, if you will? What is, for what are they trying to throw him out of his job?
Well, I think some of the things you spoke about, but Heather, Heather.
I mean, he's got two jobs, essentially. He's stripped of his police powers as a Chicago police officer because of several things. One, he made social media posts that were Islamophobic and racist, and he's facing disciplinary charges that could result in his termination before the police board. He's also facing disciplinary charges for filing a complaint against former Superintendent Eddie Johnson for marching with Father Michael Flager on the Dan Ryan a couple years back in an anti-gun protest. So he could be fired from the police department for those things, which would be unusual because it is very rare, unless you're Jason Van Dyke, essentially, to be fired from the department. Whether he keeps his job as FOP, I think, is up in the air. I didn't realize that he was facing a process within the FOP itself. So thanks for breaking that news, Austin.
It does strike me as sort of similar to the Marjorie Taylor Greene question when you're in the Republican Party. Like, do you want this person representing your organization, the people who support you? And I understand the appeal of Catanzara because he's so blunt. He's combative. He really, you know, he speaks up for this certain faction of the police department, but he is not at all polished in the way he does things, and things that he said, some of the things that he said, some of the posts he's made on social media are pretty vile. And the question is, do you want someone like that representing an organization of people who consider themselves professionals, right, and who want the respect of their community, who deserve in most cases the respect of their community? Is this the face? And John, you asked him that basically. It's like, you know, why should police officers want to have someone like you representing them? And he basically said, well, they elected me.
Well, he also said, like Marjorie Taylor Greene did, that when I said some of those things, I didn't have all of the facts. So please don't judge me by today what I said then, not knowing. For instance, in the case of the insurrection, he said that it was no big deal what happened at the Capitol. He said that was just hours into it, and only later did I discover that people, including police officers, were killed. So I take that back, and I said, well, maybe you shouldn't have said it to begin with. I mean, what's the point of being so fast with the tweet? If I was a police officer in this city, I just don't understand why you would want that guy being the face of the union. I know he's fighting for you, but are you winning? Does that help anybody? I don't understand.
I mean, I think you can make an argument that it is almost very similar to the appeal of President Trump, right? Like the goal is not necessarily success, and it's not even clear what can be considered success, but it is just that the victory is in the fight. You know, the victory is in sort of being a voice out there, calling out the mayor, calling out the teachers union, protesting Kim Fox, that in and of itself is what the rank and file Chicago police officers are looking for. And it's also complicated by the fact that they've been working without a contract for more than 3 years at this point, which means that they haven't had a raise in more than 3 years. And just like it's been tough on the mayor's staff, there's no doubt that the past year has been excruciatingly tough to be a police officer in Chicago. So, you know, that is a very combustible situation, especially when the police department is disproportionately white when you compare it to Chicago's population. It's disproportionately male. And that, I think, when you're grappling with issues of police reform and sort of policing issues, sets up really an almost an untenable position for many officers who feel, I'm sure, no doubt disrespected, but, you know, who have also done great harm to a great number of Black and Latino Chicagoans.
Yeah.
And who are under federal court oversight for routinely violating their constitutional rights, I might add.
The one thing we spoke about a bit earlier this week, John, was that you got to remember the people who are voting for that president, a lot of them are retired. And the demographic makeup of those retired folks is very different than the rank and file now. And I would love to see what the breakdown was. You know, who we police elected Catanzaro, that's for sure. How many of them are actually on the streets having to deal with crime on a day-to-day basis? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. I was talking to Superintendent Brown today about the carjackings and the crime on the CTA and the fact that maybe the police are going to have to be more involved in enforcing a mask rule on public transportation. And he said, you know, we're doing the best we can. And I don't know what he's supposed to do. I asked him, I said, those 40 extra task members who are assigned to police carjackings, are they in unmarked cars at gas stations? Like, what are you guys doing about that? And sounds like they kind of are, but, you know, you can't anticipate and catch every single carjacker. But I guess the reason I was even thinking about that was because you brought up Kim Fox, and I gave him every opportunity to say that our frustration is that these cases are not being prosecuted thoroughly. And he said, I know what you're doing here, and I'm not going to say that. His big frustration was with the justice system in general and the fact that the judges, he thinks, are being too lenient on these teenagers. You can't put a teenager in past 21 anyway, but the last one that they arrested for carjacking was 15 years old. And those kids don't go to jail for very long. And Brown sounded like that's the problem.
Well, we should match him up with Dolly Glanton, who wrote a piece just about a week ago in the Tribune, who said that we can't punish our way out of this thing. It reminds me, there was a story in the papers this morning about a guy who was carjacked. I think it was in Logan Square.
Yeah.
And they caught the guys, and the guy declined to prosecute. Said something like, they must have needed a car or something like that.
He said, I just want my stuff back. And I'm like, no, there's more to this than that. You just want your stuff back? You don't want these guys to go to jail? I thought maybe he just feared repercussions.
Well, it might be that, or it might just be that he doesn't want to get involved. If he gets the stuff back, he doesn't want to get involved in the court system, going to numerous court dates and testifying and the exposure that might put him under. Yeah, I can imagine where someone just say, look, I can't personally solve this problem, and I'm not going to go to court six times and testify, put myself in jeopardy so these guys can get probation. Hell with it.
Well, you know, now that you mention it, a few weeks ago when that lady got mugged on the train with me, police were right there. They said, come on, answer some questions. She goes, no, I don't want to talk to you guys. I want to get to work. You're not going to do anything anyway. And off she went. So, yeah, I guess that does happen.
That's fascinating, John. I didn't know that.
No. There is a sideways blizzard going on the window that I'm sitting next to right now. And I'm downtown, so I'm going to head for my bus. I'm not riding that damn train anymore. And
you can see from my Zoom background that I'm stuck on Lakeshore Drive.
Oh, that's right.
I was going to say, more concerned that you're 10 years ago.
Eric has the 10 years ago.
Buy Netflix. Buy Apple.
I know. No, buy
GameStop.
GameStop. I don't even think GameStop has been invented yet 10 years ago. I guess it was. It was probably publicly traded 10 years ago.
Probably huge, right? 10 years ago.
All right, guys. Well done. Thanks for joining us. Austin Burke, Heather Cerrone, Eric Zorn. I'm John Williams. Drop another podcast on you next week. Okay, kids.
Bye, Brandon.
Talk to you later. Bye, guys.
Later.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.